Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The trial court erred in this case by ruling that the remedy at issue here is, quote, governed by Gilliland versus Motorola, unquote.
Could I stop you right at the beginning?
Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't this a discretionary matter on the part of the court in terms of fashioning an appropriate remedy?
No, not in this case for this reason. This ruling was made on summary judgment, and the ruling was a legal ruling that the remedy here is governed by another case.
Well, wait a second. Are you saying that you believe the trial court thought it had no choice and was required to formulate this remedy?
I'm not sure. I don't know what the chancellor thought.
Is that the argument you're making, that the trial court felt compelled as a matter of law to reach this remedy?
Yes, it is, that's the way I read the opinion, because it said the remedy is governed by Gilliland. And that's just not correct. And in any case, it is, you know, this wasn't a remedy the court fashioned with discretion after trial. This was on summary judgment. After finding liability, the trial court said this is the remedy.
Well, didn't the court essentially, as part of that consideration, consider putting the parties where they had been if there had been no breach of the disclosure obligation?
And I think that's basically what he was driving at, and that's part of the error here. Because in this case, Your Honor, there was a breach of, and let me say, there was a violation of the appraisal statute and a breach of fiduciary duty of disclosure. Those findings, there was no cross appeal on that. So that's, those decisions are set. And, you know, putting the parties in the position they would have been if there hadn't been a breach of fiduciary duty of disclosure, which derives from the duty of loyalty in this case, given that it's a controlling shareholder transaction, is not the correct, that shouldn't be the driving force for the remedy. Where there's a breach of the duty of loyalty, the objective isn't to put the beneficiaries back in the position they would have been in. The objective of the remedy is to take the benefit away from the fiduciary that they derive from this transaction. If you're a fiduciary and you breach your duty of loyalty in connection with the transaction, you don't get to benefit from the transaction, regardless of the what, if any, injury happened to the beneficiaries. That's why the fiduciary duty of disclosure, this court's held, doesn't contain requirements for reliance, causation, and damages, because it doesn't matter whether the beneficiaries would have demanded appraisal or not. You know, and I think that's the key point, and that's the reasoning behind the other decisions that the trial court didn't follow. That's a long-winded answer to Your Honor's question. I hope that's...
Can I get back to my question?
Yes, Your Honor.
If the trial court had decided that it chose to follow, is it Gilliland, because after reviewing that case and the Nebel and whatever other cases, decided that that was the persuasive approach from this judge's perspective, would you still have a basis to appeal that decision?
Yes, we would be contending, Your Honor, and I guess in the alternative, we certainly do contend that it was an abuse of discretion. The selection of this remedy on summary judgment was an abuse of discretion, and if I can explain why.
Yeah, sure.
Your Honor, the wrongs here are wrongs that happened in other cases. There are really three cases that are out there that are sort of at issue in this matter. There's the Nebel versus Southwest Bancorp case. There's the Wach versus Continental Host case, and the Gilliland versus Motorola case. Let me talk about the Gilliland versus Motorola case first, because that's the one the court followed, the chancellor followed. That case is very different from this case. First of all, there was no violation of the appraisal statute, and the fiduciary duty disclosure violation was very different. That was a case where it was a two-step transaction. There was a tender offer, very public tender offer, very aggressive public litigation. Numerous decisions of the Court of Chancery about the disclosure, full disclosure, voluminous full disclosure was made in the second step when the short form merger was happening shortly thereafter. The notice of merger went out and it was a bare bones document that just basically had a copy of the appraisal statute. And the court in Gilliland said, looking to Zurn, said, well, you know, even though all the disclosure's already been made to someplace, you know, you at least have to have some reference back to that disclosure and some summary information in the notice of appraisal that goes out. That has nothing to do with this case. This case was a non-public company, not a registered public company, didn't make SEC filings, generally made no disclosure, affected a short-form merger. The document went out to the shareholders telling them they had appraisal rights. It plainly did not include disclosure of all the material facts, and it violated the appraisal statute in that it didn't attach a correct copy of the appraisal statute. Those facts, I don't see how you can say that it's within the court's discretion to say that set of facts should get the same remedy as Gilliland, especially when we turn to the second two cases that are out there, the Niebel versus Southwest Bancorp case. That case, the only violation was the failure to attach the correct copy of the appraisal statute, exactly what we have here. And Justice Jacobs, or then Vice Chancellor Jacobs, held that the proper remedy is to give all the minority shareholders the difference between the merger price and fair value. And Wacht versus Continental Host actually involved the exact disclosure violation that was at issue here, a failure to disclose how the controlling shareholder arrived at the merger price. In that case, the court held that the appropriate remedy was to pay everybody the difference between the merger price and fair value. So to me, even if the standard of review is abuse of discretion, I think it was an abuse of discretion here to not follow Niebel and Wacht and to say that Gilliland is controlling. I mean, there's no analysis. There really isn't any logical basis to reach that conclusion given those three rulings. I really do, you know, would urge the court to keep in mind that I think it's really important that when there's a set of facts and there are judicial rulings as to what happens on those set of facts, there ought to be some consistency. You know, if you have cases where something happens and this is the remedy, we should follow that those cases should be followed, and not applying a remedy in a different case on a different set of facts.
Well, the Chancellor quoted Vice Chancellor Lamb that Niebel appears to assume without deciding that all minority shareholders should be entitled to participate in the quasi-appraisal class without having to opt in or choose to participate, as would be true of a real appraisal action. So you're saying that that's an incorrect observation?
Well, I think it is. I mean, I think the Niebel opinion, it's certainly correct. I mean, we can all read the Niebel opinion, and so I can't say anything other than what it comment on anything other than what it says in the opinion. And there isn't, frankly, a lot of analysis as to why that was the remedy. But that clearly was the remedy, to award all the minority shareholders the difference between the merger price and fair value. And there's a good reason for it, even though it's not articulated in detail. But when if there's a violation of the appraisal statute, the corporation shouldn't get a second chance. I mean, shareholders, if they don't comply with the appraisal statute, they don't get a second chance to demand appraisal.
Well, let me ask, if someone does not want to participate in the appraisal, how do they, under your proposal, what do they do, opt out? And how is that done?
Well, they don't have to opt out if they, as was discussed, I think, by Vice Chancellor Strine in the Turner versus Bernstein case, you're free to decline. You don't have to do anything. These are non-opt-out class actions, disclosure claims like this, where the remedy is the same payment, payment of the same per share amount to all the minority shareholders. And as Vice Chancellor Strine said, you know, if a shareholder wants to decline the check or decline the award, they can, but they don't have to do anything in the case. They don't have to participate in the case.
Well, there's at least a theoretical risk of getting less than the merger consideration, right?
Well, let me say, I have two answers to that. The answer is no, because The remedy is to take away from, in my view, the remedy should be take away from the controlling shareholder the difference between the merger price and fair value. If it turns out that they overpaid, then there are no damages. They didn't get any benefit from the transaction, and there wouldn't be any award. But in this case, the defendants aren't even contending the price is fair. I mean, they admit that the price is unfair. That's the whole point of this transaction. They've already.
It's not a true appraisal, then, that should be conducted.
I'm not sure I understand Your Honor's question.
Well, I'm speaking in terms of the theoretical possibility of getting less than the merger consideration in an appraisal. And by requiring people to automatically be in, aren't they at risk of losing money?
No, and I the answer is no. It's not an appraisal. It's a that's why it's frustrating that this term quasi-appraisal and this is recreating appraisal, I think, is a little bit confusing. The question is, what should the remedy be if a controlling shareholder doesn't discharge its fiduciary duties and violates the appraisal statute? And my point is, under Niebel and Wach, the remedy should be to order that controlling shareholder to pay the minority shareholders the difference, if any, between the merger price and fair value. The reasoning for that rule, and that it's what is behind Niebel and Wacht, is if you don't discharge your duty of loyalty in a transaction where you're acquiring the beneficiary's assets, you don't get to keep the what I'll call the profit. I don't mean that in an accounting sense, but the benefit, which is the difference between what it's really worth and what you paid for it. So it's not appraisal, even though the valuation standard will be the same as it is in an appraisal. What's happening, I think, or what should happen is that benefit that the fiduciary got in the context of where it failed to discharge its obligations is taken away from it.
Help me understand the trial judge's focus on what he believed the General Assembly intended in the appraisal statute requiring minority shareholders to opt in. That seemed to be some significance to him and why he chose the Gilliland remedy as opposed to other possibilities. It wasn't as if he didn't consider other possibilities. But I read some of the language in there seems to suggest it was mandated by the General Assembly that he craft this remedy.
Yes, I think that was I don't know, obviously I don't know what his thinking was, but the General Assembly to me wasn't in drafting the appraisal statute wasn't commenting in any way, shape or form or intending to legislate in any way, shape or form what the remedy should be if a fiduciary doesn't discharge a fiduciary duty, which is totally separate from the statutory framework, or what the remedy should be if a shareholder or a corporation doesn't comply with the appraisal statute. I mean, I don't think
I'm having difficulty following you. That's why I'm asking you. I assume I'll be asking if it isn't answered your friends here. But it's as if there's been a breach of fiduciary duty and there comes in an appraisal or a quasi-appraisal context, then the General Assembly is saying those people who were content with the price that was offered and didn't opt in to demand appraisal, then they don't get any benefit that might otherwise flow. And that there's some public policy justification for that.
To me, that's wrong. And if there's one thing I could leave the court with, and this is my main focus, which I think is really important, which is it's not – I know it's tempting to think in a tort in tort concepts, like, well, these shareholders, let's give back to them what was taken away from them. And, you know, in some contexts, that may be appropriate. But in this context, that shouldn't be the focus, and that's where this all got sidetracked. We're talking about crafting a remedy for violating the duty of loyalty, and it doesn't matter if people would have demanded appraisal or not. Most of them probably wouldn't have. We all know that. But the remedy is the claim has no element of causation, reliance, or damages, and that's because even if people wouldn't have demanded appraisal, if you're a fiduciary and you don't discharge your fiduciary duty of loyalty, we take away, the law takes away what you derive from that that transaction, even if it really wasn't something that was taken away from the minority shareholders. For example, you know, obviously many of the minority shareholders wouldn't have demanded appraisal, and so they didn't lose the difference between the merger price and fair value. I submit that doesn't matter. That's not the point of the remedy. I know I'm into my rebuttal time. I'll use a few minutes of it. But there is another issue here besides the duty of loyalty violation, which is the violation of the appraisal statute. And putting those two together in a case where those two are present, where you had a controlling shareholder who admits that he was trying to cash out the minority shareholders for less than fair value, which is, you know, in a short-form merger, I understand under UNICAL that's permissible now. But I think you ought to be required to meet your obligations of loyalty and your statutory obligations to be entitled to cash out the minority shareholders for less than fair value. That's my point. And again, even if the standard of review, Your Honor, is abuse of discretion, I think it's met here. This case that's the sole...
Can I just ask you, without meaning to take up all the rest of your time here, if we had, hypothetically, a case where the company, the short-form merger notice included some error in the copying of the Section 262 statute, you know, let's say the last paragraph got left out or something that was very transparently in the nature of a clerical error, okay? And there was nothing else wrong with the way the notice of merger was provided to the stockholders. Would you, in that circumstance, say that it might make sense for the court to try and reconstruct the appraisal remedy, which is the only remedy that's available after a short-form merger, but that here you've got something different? You've got a problem with the failure to disclose information about value, which was a more serious problem that takes it out of just reconstructing your appraisal rights and puts you into seeking relief as a matter of fiduciary law.
Yes, Your Honor, I think that's exactly right. But I will say, in the Niebel case, it was a copying error. And, you know, there was a page that was missing, or a wrong page was included. That in the text of the document, it actually did summarize the whole Delaware appraisal statute correctly. But I think there is a difference, because I don't view that as a duty of disclosure or loyalty violation. That's a statutory violation by the surviving corporation in the merger. That's the entity that's got the obligation to issue that document in compliance with the appraisal statute. I think the court very well could say, within its discretion, you know, we're not trying to cause disgorgement of a benefit by a fiduciary for a loyalty violation. We're simply making the surviving corporation comply with the obligation that it was required to comply with at the outset. So that would be a different situation. But here we have both. I'll save my last minute and a half for rebuttal, Your Honor. Thank you. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Alan Terrell for PubCo, the appellee. At counsel's table is my associate, Meredith Stewart. Before I turn to my prepared remarks, let me clarify one thing that I think is perhaps a misconception that the appellant has raised, namely to treat this as a duty of loyalty case. It is not. It was filed as a breach of the duty of disclosure in connection with a 253 merger. Therefore, what we're looking at is a violation of Section 253. That has already been determined, and the issue on appeal is whether or not the Chancellor properly crafted his remedy for that breach of a duty of disclosure. We submit that the issue, therefore, on appeal is whether or not to accord the deference, if you will, the discretion to the lower court in crafting an equitable remedy. The appellant seems to recognize this issue. At page 11 in his opening brief, he does state that Chancery has wide discretion to grant equitable relief. Indeed, that certainly is the rule going back 25 years to Weinberger versus UOP, which stated the very same thing. Now, that could be the end of the appeal, and I could sit down, but I think that in fairness to your honors, let me pick up what I think are some of the arguments that the appellant has made in their briefs and today. It seems to me what he is saying is, in any event, even if to follow up on Justice Berger's questions about abuse of discretion, he is saying there has been abuse of discretion. As I understand the test for the reviewing court in an allegation that the lower court abused its discretion with respect to fashioning relief, the appellant must either show that the lower court failed to articulate any rational reason for the remedy selected. Well, clearly that's not the problem. We have a very thorough opinion below, and I don't believe that the appellant is really pressing that point. Rather, he is pressing the second grounds to challenge an abuse of discretion by saying that the lower court, in effect, ignored key facts and overlooked significant legal principles. Therefore, let me turn to both of those points as I've heard the argument today. With respect to the legal principles, the appellant has argued that Nebel should apply and that the Wach case should be applied, and that Gilliland ought not to be followed. If I may, let me put those legal principles in context for this appeal. It really goes back 25 years ago to Weinberg. In Weinberger versus UOP, the court dealt with a merger and developed the concept of quasi-appraisal remedy. Briefly stated, it meant that if a shareholder has been deprived of his appraisal rights through not being given the proper information to exercise his decision, the court, since it may be too late, for example, to issue a corrective disclosure and go back and re-scramble the eggs, if you will, the court will try to come up with some quasi-appraisal remedy. Let me do my math for you. 12 years later, I think it's 1995, the Nebel case came along. Nebel was the 253 case where the shareholders of Bancorp were, if you will, merged out by Southwest Bancorp. Shareholders filed an appraisal action, and in the action at the lawsuit that we are concerned with, other shareholders sought a remedy from the court. The remedy that ultimately came to be, and which the appellant is arguing here, is that fair value should be accorded because there, as alleged, there was unfairness in price, unfairness in dealing, incomplete disclosure, and, as my friend has said, a wrong page from the appraisal statute. But in that case, there was significant failures to disclose. There was not adequate information about Bancorp's business, its competition, its future earnings. Furthermore, and then Vice Chancellor Jacobs referred to it in his opinion below, he found that the price was clearly unfair because the appraisal action determined that the value was $85 a share, and the merger consideration was $41. So at that point, the court, simply applying quasi-appraisal, determined that the stockholders were entitled to fair value. A few years later, this court, in the Glassman case, focused on a 253 context as to what is fair and what is, to some extent, the remedy. And in that case, the court said, in a 253 merger, absent fraud, appraisal is the appropriate remedy for a breach of the requirements in a 253 short-form merger. Glassman, I submit, is a case that the appellant did not discuss with you today, but it is very critical, I believe, to the way the lower court in our case proceeded to craft his remedy, because he took it to mean that therefore he should look to creating what would be close to the appraisal remedy if there's been a violation of Section 253. And he did find, and we, that's not on appeal, on summary judgment, the lower court did find that the statute was violated. The general counsel for PubCo failed to be aware that a few months earlier, Section 262 had been amended. He did not include the current statute. He did not see in the statute any requirement to explain how the merger price was arrived at, and that was not in the in the notice. But nevertheless, to return to the legal principles, when Jillian comes about in 2005, the vice chancellor there focused on the quasi-appraisal remedy in light of Neville and in light of Glassman. And he determined that basically what he would try to do was to recreate as close as he could an appraisal remedy for those shareholders who wished to exercise it, but frankly an improved appraisal remedy. So what he did, he allowed them to opt in. He thought that, as in all appraisal, there is some modicum of risk. As Your Honor pointed out, that it's conceivable in appraisal proceeding you would get less than the merger price. And so accordingly, the Vice Chancellor in the Jillian case determined that a portion of the merger consideration should be returned to the corporation in escrow.
But that would not likely happen here with the amount of cash and securities on hand, right?
That is, I think that's reasonable, too. I just don't know. The merger price here was 40% over the low trading value over the last 22 months, and roughly 30% above the average trading price over the last 22 months. And that might,
in an appraisal. The chancellor said that cash and securities amounted to approximately $36 per share, $16 per share more than the merger consideration.
That's right, Your Honor. And clearly in an appraisal action, that would be the argument of the petitioners, and I suspect that the respondent would use discounted cash flow and earnings and so forth, and I can't tell you that you're right or wrong. I just pointed out there would be, certainly that's a reasonable point, though, and I won't dispute it too much with Your Honor.
And doesn't that suggest that the trial court abused its discretion in, if I'm not mistaken, requiring everybody to pay up $2 a share before they can opt in?
I don't
think so. And let me just finish it, especially when we're talking about giving back money that at this point may have been disposed of in some other fashion. So it's not as if the former stockholders are being told, well, you'll only receive a portion of the merger consideration because we're going to give you this option to pursue it. No, if you want to get any more money back, you have to first give up $2 a share.
Right. No, I understand, Your Honor. And I think what the court did below was to look to the fact that appraisal statute naturally has a certain risk to the stockholders and tried to impose a very modest risk of returning $2 per share, which would be held, if you will, in escrow.
Was that agreed upon, or was that
imposed? Yes. That was agreed upon between the parties with respect to following up from His Honor's opinion of May 30th, he designated four, if you will, requirements or criteria for the parties to consider for purpose of the revised notice. We did so. We submitted a stipulated form of notice, and he entered it on July 17th.
But the appellant did not agree to the concept that there would have to be a a payback or a pay-in, only that the court ordered that, so that the parties had to reach an agreement as to what the amount would be, right?
I believe that's right, Your Honor. And this may go to His Honor Chief Justice Steele's question about the legislative intent. I just wanted to cover that, too, because I noted that in the opinion below as well. And I think it relates to this concept of creating a quasi-appraisal. If we accept Glassman as to say that in a 253 violation you create a quasi-appraisal remedy that to some extent follows the appraisal, which would have some degree of risk, what I believe the court below was saying is that looking then to the appraisal statute, it would seem to him that the remedy here allows those shareholders who simply wish to keep the $20 per share they receive from the merger and not participate in the quasi-appraisal, they can do so. And I think there have been cases where the court has recognized that it may be stockholders for one reason or another would prefer to keep their money that they have now rather than to wait and see how a proceeding turns out.
Can I interrupt you there?
Surely.
Do you know of any cases where there's been a quasi-appraisal remedy that involved, I mean, other than Gilliland, that involved requiring stockholders to either give up cash or opt in, as opposed to it being, a class of some designation that would then take whatever benefits might flow from a subsequent trial determining fair value?
I can't recall one, but I am confident that Ms. Stewart will remind me if she finds it at the desk here, too.
Thank you.
But I think, Your Honor, the corollary, if you don't accept the approach that the Chancellor was using to search for a quasi-appraisal, some way to make it similar to an appraisal, here, for example, it was a more favorable situation for stockholders than if they had participated in the original appraisal.
But why shouldn't it be the case that, especially in a situation like 253, where stockholders have very little in the way of options, that either the company does it right and they get their proper notice, they make their choice, they live with their choice, and that's the end of it, or the company and the majority stockholder don't get it right, in which point the penalty, if you will, and I don't mean it in that way exactly, but the result, because you're fiduciaries and because you didn't get it right, is that there is a form of relief that's available to the minority to remedy what they lost out on in a more comprehensive way than simply saying we're going to now mimic what you could have gotten if it had been done correctly.
I think the answer is essentially that if the stockholders were not to put some of the merger consideration in escrow, then it would become more punitive towards the majority stockholder because there is simply risk.
Only if the majority stockholder had paid too little.
That's true. It creates that risk to the majority stockholder. But isn't the approach of Glassman to craft the appraisal as the exclusive remedy in the absence of fraud appropriate here where there has been no allegation of a breach of duty of loyalty? There's been no claim of gross overreaching or anything that would otherwise suggest that a majority stockholder has done what he's entitled to do, namely to use 253 to have a short form merger. Inadvertently, there have been disclosure violations. Therefore, the majority stockholder has suffered both the expenses, the litigation, and paying Ms. Berger's fee, attorney's fees, the cost of the additional notice, and the risk now that there are more shareholders because of this more favorable quasi-appraisal remedy. There are more shareholders participating in the quasi-appraisal than had been the case with respect to the original appraisal. So, indeed, the majority stockholder here has, if you will, paid a penalty. And I recognize Your Honor is saying we're not looking to make this punitive. We're not – Chancery Court doesn't award punitive damages. But it seems to me it is a penalty to the majority stockholder to follow the relief that the lower court fashioned here. It does pay an additional cost or expense.
Including attorney's fees?
Yes. The stockholders themselves have also gained here, too. As Berger has announced, this was a significant victory for the stockholders, and they have the additional disclosure, and they have greater rights, and they have proceeded to exercise quasi-appraisal rights more extensively than they did before. So when we step back, it would seem to me that to the extent that the standard review is abuse of the discretion by the lower court in fashioning the 253 remedy, the court below properly laid out his analysis and reasons. He considered relevant facts, and he did an exhaustive analysis of the legal authorities. I would submit, with all due deference to this court's reviewing power, you ought to affirm the decision below. Thank you.
Just a few points, Your Honors. First, Justice Berger, there is no other case like where the remedy in Gilliland was applied. I was involved in litigating Gilliland, and it was an exhaustive search. And really, that was a unique case because of very technical facts. I mean, it wasn't really a substantive violation. It was a very technical violation of failing to put a reference back to some other documents in a notice where everything had already been disclosed recently. So Gilliland was different. On the point about returning the money, Your Honor was exactly correct. We did not agree. The court's opinion says counsel shall craft I order a remedy that tries to recreate appraisal, and you have to pay back some of the money and try to negotiate that. It's specifically said in the opinion. So that we negotiated the best deal we could. We didn't agree to it. In Gilliland, interestingly, the amount that was required to be paid back was the difference between what the corporation was going to contend the fair value was and the merger price, which was roughly 10-12% difference, but that was the amount that the court set. In this case, they're not contending $20 is fair value. In fact, it's part of the record in this case. They injected it into the record. They've been paying shareholders to try to cut down this case. They've been going around paying everyone another $10 a share that they can get to take a settlement. So they're paying a 50% premium. And again, as was pointed out, the facts here, there's no basis to contend that this was a fair price.
Are you going to address Klassman, the exclusive remedy being appraisal? Mr. Terrell said you didn't.
I did. In a short-form merger under Glassman versus Unical, there's no question that there's no entire fairness claim, that the exclusive remedy is normally appraisal. But there is one other obligation, as Glassman says. You have to discharge your fiduciary duty of disclosure. And that's what we're here talking about. Where you don't discharge your fiduciary disclosure, what should the remedy be? It should not be to try to recreate appraisal. I agree that if, and I apologize, Your Honors can just tell me to sit down.
You're answering the question. Go ahead.
My point is, what is trying to be achieved here? That's the starting point. There's been this duty of disclosure violation. If you're trying to recreate appraisal rights for the shareholders, I agree. This remedy does that. My point is that's a legally incorrect focus of what the objective is. The objective is where there's a duty of loyalty violation, and my friend says that this is not a duty of loyalty case. Yes, it is. It's a disclosure. It's a duty of disclosure case, and as all the opinions say, that duty derives from the duties of care and loyalty. This is a blatantly conflicted transaction where the controlling shareholder set the freeze-out price. So the disclosure issue clearly arises from loyalty versus care. So, but the what the trial court should be trying to do is not recreate appraisal rights, which might be arguably an appropriate remedy, as Justice Berger pointed out, for a technical violation of the appraisal statute by the corporation. But here it's the controlling shareholder that failed to discharge his duty of loyalty, and that entity didn't know, wasn't the one that was required to provide the appraisal rights to begin with. I mean, what we're trying to do for them is to take away the benefit they derive from the transaction. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.